and welcome to the Locus Roundtable podcast. Today I'm talking with the noted short story author, Ted Chang. Ted, if you want to say hi.
Hi, Karen.
Hello. And one of the things that we've talked about quite a bit over the years is the work of Greg Egan.
Yes, yes.
And you mentioned to me once last year that of Greg Egan's books, Distress was your favorite?
Yes.
I was wondering if you could talk maybe a little bit about why that was, or is?
Well, I guess, for me, Distress has, it has the most going on in it. It has a lot of different things going on in it, and they all tie together, they all resonate in a way which, well, in a way that I was really impressed by when I first read the novel. It's something which I guess I feel like his other novels, which I, you know, also enjoy, I feel like they are generally more focused on a single theme, and but whereas in Distress he had sort of multiple themes that all tied together, which really impressed me. So that's why I think of it as his most successful novel.
I can see that. I have to admit, the world building of so many of the near futures that were written in the 90s, that struck me as very incredibly not dated reading it today.
Yeah, it's it is interesting. Actually, although, I mean, I often feel that reading Greg Egan's work from the, you know, 90s, his futures, I think, were often, you know, prescient in ways that, you know, were probably, unexpected. Because they're in... in Permutation City, he has this scene where someone's a character, her email, basically it's her, she has a sort of a super sophisticated email filter, which is essentially designed to identify spam, because these spam messages, they're trying to tell when they are when they're being opened by an actual human versus being checked by an email program. And so essentially the spam filter creates this virtual environment in which to, you know, open these email messages, and then the email there's this particularly sophisticated email which has somehow figured out that this is not an actual human, and it will not reveal its contents until it actually is being opened by an actual human.
Right, right.
And even though you know that we don't have that, you know, this was that was written at a time when, you know, email was still, you know, not in wide use. There was no spam. Essentially, I mean, I don't think there was any, you know, spam was not a real problem then, but he sort of anticipated sort of an arms race between, you know, email recipients and spam generators. And, you know, we have seen an arms race of sorts between that, and it did not take that specific, you know, course that, you know, Egan had in the novel, I thought that was really prescient of him to see that there would be this sort of you know, never-ending battle between junk mail and efforts to curb junk mail.
Right. Yeah. The second order consequence, as it was.
Yes. Yes.
And then by Distress, he's got something more or less like ubiquitous Wi-Fi access.
Yes.
Where pretty much wherever the narrator is, he can upload video, he can download information, he can search some kind of, you know, universal database, which of course wasn't called Wikipedia, but had certain, you know, the same characteristics. And it actually took me a minute. I was reading through and going, oh yeah, that all sounds very reasonable. And then going, wow, wait, he was writing this when I was still using dial-up. You know?
Yes, yes. And, you know, there... It really does reflect a lot of, you know, sort of the amazing conveniences that we have now. And someone reading it for the first time now might not realize just what an extrapolation it was back in the distant past of 1995.
Right. Well, sometimes it is hard to remember back 15 years ago.
I mean, yes, it is, and it, but you know, he, you know, while his, you know, obviously, you know, it is not a perfectly accurate prediction. You know, that was certainly, you know, I mean, that is not science fiction's goal, of course.
Of course,
and but yeah, he really did sort of intelligently extrapolate, you know, the way that a lot of technology has subsequently developed. So yeah, it's impressive on many levels.
Absolutely. And then one of the other things that really struck me about Distress, I agree that the way he did the world building, not just in the, you know, the things that still feel accurate to us, but in a lot of ways, his world building ended up resonating really nicely with the overall theme he was setting up. But one of the other things that really struck me was the whole philosophy that was the point of contention, basically the main plot point of the whole book.
Right. Anthrocosmology.
Exactly. It struck me about halfway through that I was reading it, I'm like, if that turns out to be true, which, spoiler alert, it does by the end of the book, then I feel like he's actually thrown that book's universe into what Gary's calling an alternate cosmology.
Hmm.
And I guess maybe that's not totally accurate, because there's nothing... I guess there's nothing in Distress that is contradictory to anything we know right now.
I mean, I guess I think of alternate cosmology as, you know, yes, a story set in a universe where it is clearly in contradiction to what we currently observe.
Mm.
Where, but you know, most science fiction, you know, that has, for instance, faster than light travel, they are assuming some, you know, some future expansion of physical theory which allows faster than light travel, but which is otherwise, you know, consistent with what we observe today.
Mm-hmm.
And those aren't really alternate cosmology stories, because in their speculative physics, they aren't proposing that it is, you know, they aren't proposing things which directly contradict what we see right now.
Right, okay.
And so I think in that sense, you know, Egan's, the speculative physics in Distress and most of his other novels, yeah, I guess probably all of his other work, yeah, I guess I would not really qualify, I don't think they qualify as alternate cosmology as I understand the term.
That's fair. I guess one of the reasons I especially was saying that was with Quarantine. He points out that, you know, the core idea in Quarantine is having human consciousness be able to collapse the quantum waveform, and that this being a special property of human consciousness. And he will say himself, of all the interpretations of quantum mechanics, he does not believe that this one is true. But it is consistent with all the known measurements and observations and et cetera, et cetera. So I had a tendency to sit there and go, well, you know, that kind of is an alternate cosmology.
To the extent that it was, you know, if it's consistent with, you know, with our observations, then I guess, yeah, to me that doesn't make it an alternate cosmology. Although I believe since writing Quarantine, you know, Egan has sort of posted a correction that he realized that he misunderstood a certain aspect of quantum mechanics. The consequences that he extrapolated would not actually logically follow from his premise. In that sense, it was sort of an unintentional alternate cosmology.
Right. I've never felt that science fiction could sort of be quote unquote blamed for any new revelations that happened after it was written.
Well, yes, yes. And although I can't remember the specific details, but I think the error wasn't something that was discovered after the novel was written, but it was something that he had misunderstood at the time.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, I'd have to look it up to find the details.
Yeah, I have to admit, speaking as somebody who's doing research on Egan's life, his website is just a researcher's dream. An amazingly detailed bibliography. Every story he's ever published, where it was published, all the different translations. And he keeps a very up-to-date set of notes and explanations of the science behind his stories. Sometimes not for the faint of heart, but I can see where he probably is, you know, keeping up with the implications of what he's written in the past and how those are playing out.
Yeah, his website... yeah, it's very impressive, and it's educational in many different ways.
Well, and I remember when I read Incandescence, I read it cover to cover and went, gosh, I really wish there had been more than just two figures, you know, two actual pictures in that book. And then I went to his website and went, oh, and here it is all animatedly Java applet laid out for me. That's very nice.
You know, in some... if there's some version of... an ebook, in which those could have been incorporated more smoothly into the text in a way that, you know, cannot be accommodated by a print book.
Absolutely, this is one of the only books I've ever really wished could have gone that way. Most of the time, I don't think having, you know, for most pieces of fiction, having animations would just be distracting or hyperlinks. I think there's a reason that hyperlink novels haven't necessarily taken off yet, but that's one where it really would have helped.
Yeah, I mean, it is the rare novel which is trying to explain some pretty abstruse points of science, and those would really be easier to understand with some, you know, some animations accompanying them.
Mm-hmm.
That is not true of the vast majority of novels.
Absolutely. Let's see. Another thing I was thinking about with Distress. Actually, this is something I wanted to ask you. I came across just one little, like a one sentence throwaway world building sentence in Distress, and it talked about Casper software being grown and being taught, and I happen to wonder if you'd thought of that, or if that had played any germination in your life cycle of software objects idea. On a conscious level, I mean, obviously, no. You know.
Okay. Yeah, I understand. I mean, it was something which actually at. You know, I noticed that line in Distress as well, but you know, I can't say that was the sort of germ for me, because you know that the idea that software would need to be grown or trained is something which I think, you know, I'd been thinking about before I ever read Distress. You, my reaction on reading it was that it's like, yes, I completely agree that that is the best way to create intelligent software. It's interesting that the Casper software turns out to be, you know, surprisingly capable in the novel, unexpectedly capable, because it seems capable of comprehension in a way that their conventional software does not. But you know, the conventional software in the novel is still I guess pretty person-like, I think. The protagonist's his kind of secretary app, it doesn't have a personality, but you know, it has a you know, an extremely sophisticated sort of natural language interface,
mm-hmm.
so that he can talk with it exactly as he would a person. I don't know. I sort of wonder, like, I sort of have my doubts as to whether you can have such a good natural language interface to conventional software, because I think it's more likely that our natural language interface will still, you know, even no matter how good it gets, it will still involve, you know, sort of framing things the way we frame them to Google search right now, which is, and you know, we don't really speak to Google search the way we would speak to a person.
Right. Yeah. Natural language really still seems to be one of those barriers that we haven't overcome yet. Although I guess that was one of the points of the whole Watson on Jeopardy experiment.
Well, except that again, you know, Watson on Jeopardy, you know, doesn't understand anything outside the context of Jeopardy clues. You know, you can't have a conversation with Watson in any fashion.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
You can't. I don't think you can even ask Watson a question if you're not phrasing it in the form of a clue that Jeopardy clues are usually phrased in, because you know, I think it's all about. I think what Watson is, you know, special purpose, customized to, you know, interpret just those clues and return responses in the form of a question. I don't think you can ask it, like, what is the capital of Missouri, and it'll tell you. I don't even think it can do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I heard something that said that IBM was planning to export sort of the core of the Watson software to go look at, do something like data mining for medical research. So there's got to, they must have some other implementations in mind for it in the future.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure the underlying technology does have, you know, a lot of other applications. It is an impressive piece of sort of parsing software, parsing and data mining. But yeah, I mean, it's still nothing like a natural language interface. Because again, yeah, you cannot talk to it in any, you know, in any natural way.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, to get back to, you know, your original question about growing software. I mean, yeah, that is something that I had thought, you know, long ago, like probably back in the early 90s, that, you know, that was the way that, to me, that made the most sense. So yeah, it was nice to see that. Oh, hey, maybe Greg Egan feels the same way. but as you say, it's just a sort of an offhand remark in the novel, and it's not something that he, I guess, it, you know, he didn't really pursue it in depth, probably until maybe Crystal Knights. I think that's probably the offhand. That's the one that that I can think of where he really investigates that topic.
Well, before that, the only other one I'd throw out there would be Learning to Be Me.
Yeah, I guess Learning to Be Me. That is also, I guess, another example. Although.
More constrained in a weird way.
Well, because, you know, yes, it is, it's an emulation of of one specific human being. And so no one's actually training, no one is actually making an effort to train the software. The software is just being trained at the same time that the person is growing up.
Right, right.
No one actually is spending any time with a baby computer program,
right,
raising it. So I guess, that is the difference in my mind.
That makes sense. Well, and of course, in so many of his other novels after Distress, you almost didn't need, well, how would you say? Because I'm thinking the next one is Diaspora, and of course you do have the first chapters of Diaspora are the orphan consciousness being born.
Yes.
But
yes.
That's a very different phenomenon than quote unquote just AI.
Well, because there he's talking about a society of most of which consists of uploaded humans, and the opening section of Orphanogenesis, I think that's the first. It's the first digital mind which has, the first one that is purely digital origins, that has no, that isn't based on an upload of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
That's my recollection.
Either that, or it didn't have seeds sort of chosen and custom tweaked by uploaded humans. Because I think there had been other. The implication was, other uploaded humans had gotten together to reproduce and make their new, offspring.
Right.
But this one was the first one where it just sort of spontaneously happened.
Yeah, without being sort of designed to embody or to contain traits of parents.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. So the Diaspora does have, in a very different context, a depiction of the sort of the growing training of an artificial mind.
But in a weird way, I was just thinking of the sort of neat trick that he pulls, where you never think of Yatima as really, quote, an AI. You always think of Yatima as a character.
Yes,
pretty much
yes.
Like any other character. And actually, now that I'm reminding myself, well, no, it's a spontaneously generated artificial intelligence construct. I'm like, now I'm a little wondering why I make that distinction. Oh, well, there are some entities in science fiction that are AIs, like HAL 9000 or what have you, and then there are characters who simply happen to be digital.
I think the difference has to do with the roles that these things play in fiction, and it is sort of analogous to outside of fiction, seeing someone as like a slave versus seeing someone as a person.
Mm.
Because when, because I think, you know, most of the time, AIs in fiction, they are sort of taking on the role of, well, yeah, they're taking on the role of slaves, or either, you know, super obedient servants, or super competent slaves, or something along those lines. And they're not real agents. They only serve, their purpose is to, provide help to the main characters. They provide,
they're still viewed in terms of their utility.
Yes, they are just helpful tools in a sense. But yeah, they have no real agency. They are not really worthy of consideration. Which I think is analogous to the treatment of slaves in history. They're useful, they're necessary, but they aren't really people.
Mm-hmm.
And the occasional story where some artificial intelligence is actually the protagonist, that is in a lot of ways as novel an idea as probably the idea that that slaves actually could have feelings of their own and desires, and might actually have all the properties of human beings. It's not something that people want to think about. Like if you have an economy that is built on slavery, you really don't want to think about that.
Yeah.
And in the same way, in fiction, you don't really want to, a lot of times in science fiction, you want the utility that comes with having some kind of really useful servant, and so you have you want the utility of slaves, but you don't want to really think about the the implications of that.
Mm-hmm.
And because you just call them AIs, and you can sort of dismiss them.
Might be a sort of ethical get out of jail free card.
Yes, it's the good parts only version of slavery. you get all the advantages, but none of the guilt.
Right. I wonder if that viewpoint has gotten a little harder to sustain as, sort of post-colonialism and a greater awareness of some of these dynamics has permeated through. Because the only reason I'm saying that is because I've been tracking some of the different tropes that I see, especially in the short fiction that I read.
Mm-hmm.
And robots especially, and AI to a lesser degree, has almost disappeared. From the vast majority of core SF stories, especially short stories that I've read over the last year or so.
I guess I think of those as being separate trends, because I mean, whether increasing awareness of like post-colonial issues, whether to the extent that manifests in science fiction, I guess I'd say it has more. I would think of it more in the context of alien races, or primarily depictions of alien races.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason for the the diminished appearance of diminishing frequency of robots in science fiction has to do with the fact that you know, by now most people realize, you know, technology is not going that direction. We are, you know, we don't see robots around us. We see, you know, we see the direction that computer technology is moving in, and it's not robots.
Mm, good point.
So, I think it's sort of similar to, you know, yeah, we don't see a lot of flying cars in science fiction anymore, simply because, you know, I mean, by now, I think most writers have gotten sort of, you know, gotten the message that, yeah, technology is not going down that avenue. However, I think that, I mean, so that accounts for like robots, but I think, I mean, artificial intelligence, well, again, you know, I think to the extent that it, you know, if it is diminishing in fiction, in science fiction, it is because, you know, we writers are becoming, you know, are acknowledging the fact that our software, you know, does not resemble the artificial intelligences of old. You know, we're not getting any closer to HAL.
Right. Although I feel like we're getting closer. How do I put it? We're getting closer to HAL faster than we're getting closer to a manned Jupiter mission. If you see what I mean.
Interesting.
And yet, I read way more stories about people out in the outer solar system than I read about, you know, core AI type stories. And again, the data is, this is a fairly short data span, but, you know.
Okay. That is interesting.
So that would make me wonder if it's not just how much we're perceiving one versus the other as being storyable, to borrow Clute's term, right now. Where, you know, it's still really easy to make a good story out of people out in the, you know, say the Saturnian moons or what have you. You can do almost anything with that as a setting, but maybe it's a little harder to get some new thematic traction with the AI question. I mean, obviously, Life Cycle is one of the you know, really outstanding AI stories of the last few years, but also kind of one of the few.
I guess, you know, I mean, I suppose, you know, without any hard numbers to back it up, all I can say is that, I mean, I feel like I still see plenty of AIs in fiction, but that could just be because, you know, it's something that I'm sort of sensitive to because it's something I've thought about, and I feel like a lot of stories still include some like helpful household AI, which acts like a butler,
yeah,
or some, you know, some helpful ship, you know, starship AI, which, you know, acts like a, you know, a hyper competent crew member. That still, I think, shows up regularly in science fiction. And I guess probably the reason I notice it is because, you know, it's something that I feel like, you know, it remains unexamined. The fact that there's sort of this whole, you know, I feel like there's this all these moral implications which are being glossed over.
It's because, true. Sorry, I guess they're backgrounded probably 10 times the rate at which they're foregrounded.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah, I'd say, yeah, I would agree that, you know, it's almost never foregrounded, but I feel like they appear, you know, in the background of stories, and because I think that AIs that behave the way that they're depicted as behaving, because I think such things, you know, cannot be ordinary software. I don't think ordinary software can do that. I think they have to have some sort of consciousness, and they had to have been raised somehow. And so I think that there are these, there's this whole backstory, which sort of implied but not examined. And yeah, you know, they're, it's not just, and it's not just AIs. I think, because I think similar issues arise with things like various types of clone races. Because I think, you know, there's still a lot of stories where, yeah, they're like these sort of genetically engineered clone soldiers or cloned servant classes. Or, you know, even cloned sex slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a little, you know, there's, you know, generally some more awareness of, you know, the sort of moral implications of that. But still, I guess, it's still sort of backgrounded rather than foregrounded. Because, you know, what exactly, you know, what, you know, how did this come about? Who was it that first, how did they first decide to create a clone army of soldiers?
Who thought that was an efficient economic investment?
Yeah, I mean, what was the scenario in which someone said, for the very first clone soldier, you know, you don't even know how it's going to turn out as an adult. So, you know, you don't know if it's going to be a good soldier. So someone presumably had this idea like, yeah, I think this bunch of genes will probably turn out to be a good soldier. So I suggest that we put a couple million dollars and 20 years into this project. And if that one turns out, then we can do it 100,000 times, you know, on a mass scale. Or did someone say like, yeah, I think we should invest billions of dollars to make this giant army. I think that in 20 years they will be kick-ass soldiers. I mean, right now all we have are, you know, these sort of genetic models and 100,000 angry babies. But you know, I feel confident that that this will be the best use of, you know, these several billion dollars. And who was it that who did they hire to raise this, you know, these 100,000, you know, aggressive babies?
Yeah, I mean, they still got to get fed somehow.
Yeah, you know, it's like who was taking care of, you know, 100,000, you know, aggressive 2-year-olds, you know, 100,000 aggressive, you know, 13-year-olds. I think that's expensive. You know? You couldn't pay me to do that.
Oh, good Lord, no.
Yeah, so, you know, like, I feel like there's this, you know, there's this whole big story that sort of, you know, that I wonder about, which, you know, always goes sort of unanswered, or just, you know, it's glossed over.
Glossed over, yes.
And, you know, you just have a story in which, like, yes, we have this clone, we cloned this excellent soldier, and we have an army made up of, you know, 100,000 of this excellent soldiers. Like, well, I mean, yes, that's very handy, but how did you get it? Or, you know, yes, we have this entire, you know, servant class of, you know, we had this really excellent, this excellent servant, and we cloned him, and now we have a giant, you know, an army of 100,000 of these excellent servants. But yeah, who exactly raised them? Who, how did they know it would be a worthwhile investment?
I really think it does sort of speak to the sort of differing uptake of knowledge about economics and economic realities, in such that we actually do have a lot fewer manned adventures in the outer solar system stories now, simply because most people are, as you say, are becoming cognizant that's just not, we've not yet found the economic model that makes that feasible or attractive or worth investing in, at least not right now. But maybe somehow miss that a clone army might equally not be a worthwhile economic investment for a rich economy.
You know, yeah, I guess I feel like I don't know. Yeah, I guess I feel like people don't appreciate just how expensive it would be, and how the current alternative, you know, what we currently do is, you know, we just hire people, you know, we pay people to, you know, to fight, you know, or to act as, you know, employees or servants or whatever. And you know, that model works pretty well.
and they end up raising and feeding and educating themselves, generally speaking.
I mean, yes, you know, the costs are all, you know, all the costs of raising them, that's already been taken care of. You know, one of the things that, like, occurs to me, that one of the things that once occurred to me is that the, you know how they have those, things called CAPTCHAs, where they ask you to type in some letters to prove that you're a human, like if you're creating a new email account or something.
Yeah, I've often thought that if ever we were going to have a huge revolutionary breakthrough in pattern recognition software, it was going to be driven by that same arms race that you were talking about.
I mean, yeah, and that is, you know, certainly, you know, one way it could come about. But the thing is, so, I mean, right now, there are people, I guess, like basically spam, you know, type people, you know, spammers. You know, they hire people to fill out those CAPTCHA forms.
Yeah.
You know, for like, you know, a penny each or something, and they use people to do that one part of the, you know, email registration process, and then they can go and, you know, then they have what they need to send out spam.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, they're still hiring people to do that. Because it is cheaper to hire people to do that.
Absolutely.
Than it is to, you know, than it is to develop a program that could do it. Developing the software to do that is still very, very difficult. But yeah, you can hire people to do that pretty cheaply. And also, like, if you had to, would you want clones to do that? I mean, you would, let's say, you know, like, you don't need a highly educated clone to do that, but by God, how much would it cost you to clone people to do that? You know, you could have the dumbest clones, you know, imaginable, but the cost of creating, you know, a clone army to fill out those CAPTCHAs for you, you know, it'd be astronomical. So it just seems like, you know, most of the time the existing alternative is cheaper than either creating a clone army or creating artificial intelligence. These are all much more complicated than just hiring regular people.
It's interesting how the economics completely flip when you leave Earth's gravity well. Because you're right, in most terrestrial applications that you can think of, if you just need some people to do a job that people are capable of, a lot of times it's just cheaper to hire the people than to develop the technology to do it a different way. But as soon as you have to talk about, you know, putting astronauts in space, it's almost always cheaper to send a robot because you don't have to give them oxygen and food and all these other things. So, you know,
and of course you don't need to bring them back.
Right.
robots are dispensable. Once they've done their job, you can just, you know, leave them out there. Humans, we feel bad about, you know, doing that. Humans, we feel like we really need to bring them back to Earth alive.
Although the funny thing is, when Buzz Aldrin was saying that he recommended that we should consider at least making the first mission to Mars, manned mission to Mars, one way, you know, do the supply drop, the dumb supply right. drop thing, and then just have people give it their best shot to colonize. You know, honestly, I don't think you'd lack for volunteers.
Oh, true. But of course, you know, the idea is to for them to establish an ongoing settlement, as opposed to, oh, like, let's send a human to take measurements of Venus's atmosphere, and then we'll just let him burn up.
Yeah,
that's... No one volunteers for that. Yeah. That would just be, that's totally unpalatable.
Although, oh my goodness, do you remember this Cordwainer Smith story specifically about dropping people on Venus? Oh, what was that called? The day the people fell?
I don't remember. I'm not...
Oh, sorry, I'm a big Cordwainer Smith fan from far back, but he specifically... And speaking of Venus specifically, of course he was working back in the before they knew that Venus was, the temperature of molten lead. So you could imagine, it ever working out to drop people there. But specifically going into the different attitudes towards human life in, the sort of American settlement that, was very expensive and had very few people and wasn't doing very well. And then he posited, and again, this is back in the 1950s, a Chinese expedition that basically just dropped a million poorly equipped people on the surface of Venus and said, well, some of you will survive to figure it out. And, oh man, it's a heartbreaking story.
I'll have to look that one. I mean, I've read a bunch of Cordwainer Smith, but I have not read that one.
Yeah, it's not part of his Rediscovery of Man timeline. It's much nearer future than that. And of course, it's I'm sure the genesis of it stemmed from his time living in China and then as a diplomat and a CIA guy in his real life.
Right, right. Yeah, if we had a different the idea that people were expendable, we probably I don't know. Would we be sending people to take measurements of Venus?
Well, it still just may not be worth it, just because what are you going to do with that data? Are you going to sell it? What monetary value could you extract from?
Yeah. It's just that because so far we don't need them to gather. I mean, we don't have tasks for them to do in the Venusian atmosphere, which require a human being.
Right, one way or return trip, either way.
Yeah. Most of the tasks that we are looking for are fairly simple, can be automated readily. There's no need to send humans, even if you're going to sacrifice them. Although, I just remember I was reading about in the Chernobyl incident, I read that there was this one point in which they had to clear radioactive debris from some location, and the radioactivity was so high that they could not use robots because the circuits would not operate under so much radioactivity.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent people because they needed that debris cleared, and so they sent people to their doom to get that to clear that debris.
Right.
So there are occasionally circumstances where we do that, but most of the time we do not. Most of the time it is the various bomb defusing robots. Most of the time, we value human life so much that we are willing to blow up pretty expensive robots rather than risk a human being.
Right. Although we do still anthropomorphize them.
Yes. We definitely do. The robots, the robots that we, have defusing bombs, they're not autonomous in any way.
They're just completely remote controlled.
Yeah.
I just remember there was an episode of MythBusters where I forget which police department supplied an actual bomb defusing robot for the episode, and Grant Imahara was more or less just bonding with it.
Yes. I mean, we definitely are prone to that.
And yet, bringing it back full circle, it's still so easy to just we'll just write an AI in the background and not necessarily think about what it might be thinking when it's not giving its nice, helpful butler answers.
Yeah, and in the same way that you know, if you were like in the, you know, the upper class in 1910 England, you didn't really think about what, you know, your servants were thinking about when they weren't working.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of, I mean, a lot of times that was just something that simply didn't occur to you. Their job was to serve, and that was it. And I think probably on, you know, plantations in the antebellum South, even if you were a very benevolent slave owner, I mean, you probably didn't think that much about what your slaves were thinking or feeling outside of their jobs.
Yeah, I read a really good book, Bill Bryson's latest of course he only writes nonfiction. It's called At Home, and it talks about domesticity throughout the ages, and he spends a lot of time talking about the 19th century in England. And it was just stunning to me how much human effort or how much human labor went into basically maintaining the lifestyle of the middle and upper classes. And
yes,
how
yes.
much the middle and upper classes spent time complaining about the quality of help they were getting. they're people who kept, you know, very detailed diaries or wrote very detailed letters that give us good insight, of course, to a broadly literate public. And there was one couple that went through something like 47 servants in 30 years or something like that, because they could just never find somebody who was up to, quote-unquote, their standards. And you're like, oh my lord, what were they asking? You know, of course, they were the kind of middle class who could only afford maybe one servant.
Right.
And so that one poor girl would have to do everything. And yeah, they didn't seem to spend much time speculating about the servant's internal, you know, state of mind or morale.
Yeah, you know, it never occurs to them to wonder, are we asking too much? You know, are these demands in some way unreasonable? Because you don't have to think about them as people. They're just servants.
Right, right.
So I think with AIs in science fiction, you know, they still sort of serve that role. They appear in the background of fiction. And, you know, you sort of, you know, I guess probably most authors, they feel like because they're artificial intelligences, they have, you know, they have no other desires besides, you know, giving the helpful answer. And so there is no moral dimension to it. Because, yeah, in the same way that, I mean, there's no moral dimension to, you know, using Google and feeling like, oh, are we ignoring Google? But the thing is that again and again in science fiction, these helpful AI servants, you know, household computers or ship computers, they act in ways that Google does not act.
You know, I was just thinking about the difference between Data on Star Trek Next Generation and the computer voiced by Majel Barrett.
Right.
We spend lots and lots and lots of episodes contemplating Data's humanity and how, you know, consciousness and self-consciousness and sentience and implications, but no one ever asks what the Enterprise ship computer thinks about all of it.
Yeah. Data has the status of a character.
Right.
So he gets that consideration, but the ship computer does not have that status. For some reason, I guess we think that, it's sort of an assumption in a lot of science fiction that an entity like the shipboard computer can just be ordinary software, just like Google.
Right.
I don't believe that is possible.
The more you study the software engineering that goes into both something as sophisticated now as Google and something as sophisticated as we want, like the Starship computer, it's easy to see your point.
Something something that sophisticated, I think, you know, will have to have some kind of life history, life experience. We'll have to have some, you know, consciousness and desires, you know, would be sort of as deserving of consideration as, you know, as Data, the character.
Hmm. Yeah, so it's sort of interesting. So we've gone on and basically the computers readers don't see, as it were.
Yeah. I should say that, you know, it's not that I think that conscious computers, I don't think that conscious software is inevitable or this is something that we, you know, will necessarily have to deal with, because I don't think that, you know, we are going to actually go that route. Because, you know, Google is not conscious, and I don't think we don't want Google to be conscious.
Yeah, on some level, that would be very disturbing.
I mean, yeah, I mean, Google would not be any more useful to us if it were conscious.
Quite possibly.
I don't think it would be. The actual course of, you know, software development is not directed toward conscious software. For the most part, we don't want it. And that, in one sense, that's fine. That's great. You know, we don't have to. We will not be forced to confront these moral issues. But on the other hand, you know, the way it's often depicted in science fiction, you know, you have your obedient shipboard AI who also occasionally makes these sort of dry, quippy remarks, like Jeeves does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no, actually, you know, Google doesn't do that either. And yeah, you can't have one without the other. You can't have it be making these, you know, these quippy remarks without, you know, bringing in this whole raft of sort of moral implications. Either it's ordinary software or, you know, there are real issues to consider. But if it's ordinary software, it's not going to be making those quippy remarks.
Right, right. Interesting things to consider. Yeah, there's a lot to world building that if you gloss over it, it leaves some fairly gaping holes.
In some ways, you know, it's like the there are these tropes of science fiction which we take for granted. You know, just like, you know, with interstellar travel, you know, that's sort of taken for granted by a lot of science fiction. But, you know, if you stop to really think about sort of the economics of interstellar travel, you know, it becomes much less plausible. But, you know, most of the time, you know, you don't want to think about that. You just want to have your interstellar travel in your story.
Right. Of course, attitudes can shift, like we did see with the solar system exploration stories.
Yes,
that used to be taken for granted, and now events have borne out that we can't.
With artificial intelligence or robots, I think their use in a lot of science fiction is just, you know, it's for convenience. It's an accepted trope. It's handy, you know, in the same way that interstellar travel is handy.
Mm-hmm.
It's convenient, and so, you know, people just throw it into their story and then get on with whatever story it is that they're really interested in telling.
Right.
If you spend all your time, you know, thinking about the economics of interstellar travel, you know, yeah, you can't. Most of the time, that prevents you from telling some other story.
Right, right. Not for the faint of heart.
No.
Okay, well, that sounds like a fairly good place to wrap this up. But
okay.
I wanted to thank you so much for coming on, and the traditional closing is to ask if you have anything in the works or anything, any works that you'd like people to go out and investigate.
No.
Well, of course, you've got Life Cycle of Software Objects, which is up for awards this year and is available from Subterranean Press.
Yes, yes. But other than that, I have nothing else to shill for right now.
Gotcha. But thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful.